Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Did you know Tide has been upgraded to provide an even better clean and cold water? Tide is specifically designed to fight any stain you throw at it, even in cold. Butter? Yep. Chocolate ice cream? Sure thing. Barbecue sauce? Tide's got you covered. You don't need to use warm water. Additionally, Tide Pods let you confidently fight tough stains with new ColdZyme technology. Just remember, if it's got to be clean, it's got to be Tide.
We are living in a computer-programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed and some alteration in our reality occurs. We would have the overwhelming impression that we were reliving the present, deja vu, perhaps in precisely the same way, hearing the same words, saying the same words. I submit that these impressions are valid and significant. And I will even say this, such an impression is a clue that at some past time point, a variable was changed, reprogrammed as it were, and that because of this, an alternative world branched off, that some of my fictional works were in a literal sense true. I wrote out these dreams in novel after novel, story after story, to name two in which this prior ugly present obtained most clearly. I cite The Man in the High Castle and my 1974 novel about the U.S. as a police state called Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. I'm going to be very candid with you. I wrote both novels based on fragmentary residual memories of such a horrid slave state world. People claim to remember past lives. I claim to remember a different, very different present life. I know of no one who has ever made this claim before, but I rather suspect that my experience is not unique. What perhaps is unique is the fact that I'm willing to talk about it. The only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed and some alteration in our reality occurs. We would have the overwhelming impression that we were reliving the present, deja vu, perhaps in precisely the same way, hearing the same words, saying the same words. I submit that these impressions are valid and significant. And I will even say this, such an impression is a clue that at some past time point, a variable was changed. Because of this, an alternative world branched off.
We are indeed living in a computer simulated world, and those words by Philip K. Dick in 1977 in Metz, France, are truly foundational. Wondering if those words are what opened the portals into so many red pills and red pill suppositories, and here we are just catching up with the master himself. The empire never ended, but can it end? That's what we're going to find out today. So welcome, everybody, to AM Bitnostic Radio. So good to see you. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. Yes, we're writing our own gospel and living our own myth. We're running with those searching for the truth and avoiding those who have found it. We are not the final authority on anything, but we hope to be an endless possibility for everything. You are the final authority, have always been, and it's time to find out who you really are and what reality is not. So again, welcome everybody on this Jupiter day. And today we have a show, well, the topic, of course, is near and dear to my heart. And our guest brings so much more to the table that expands on this. And that is Jack Hart. Jack, thank you very much for coming on the show a second time.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Miguel. It's great as always. Looking forward to it.
Indeed. Our last one was a very popular show, moved a lot of needles. And this time you're here to talk about your new book, Brave New World. So we will certainly share that gnosis with the audience. And with us, too, we've got Graham Pong. Graham, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good, Miguel. Looking forward to hearing what Philip Dick had to say about the Empire, since we're a couple of weeks away from the latest pomp and circumstance tag.
Yeah, I assure you that on November 5th, the Empire is not going to end, regardless of what happens. It's going to continue unabated because it is far bigger than whatever the media and the social media is telling us right now, or spoon feeding us in our digital and reality worlds. But anyway, great to see everybody in the audience as always. And I'll keep reminding you, if you have any questions for Jack about Philip K. Dick or some of the other topics and incredible figures that we will be covering today, we will certainly get to you. Please super chat them and so forth. Well, Jack, it's been a few simulated realities since you were last on the show. So give the audience quickly a brief bio of who you are.
So I have been, for the last decade or so, I've been in addition to being an author, I've been the proprietor and gatekeeper of a website called Technostics, which is basically the balance of technology and gnosis, the balance of artifact and epiphany, if you will. And so I've been online ever since really the computer revolution of the 80s, which was kind of launched our whole modern simulation.
Right.
I've authored a trilogy of books called the Technostics Trilogy, or as I like to think of it, the Heresies Trilogy. We spoke about those books the last time I was on your show. And since then, I've put out this new book, Brave New World, a guerrilla anthography of high strangeness, which is kind of the predominant paradigm we find ourselves in, surprisingly.
Or maybe
unsurprisingly.
Unsurprisingly, because again, these cats, like in your book, from Philip K. Dick to William Gibson to Robert Anton Wilson to Terence McKenna, they were telling us what was down the pipe. It wasn't this utopia of other sci-fi and occultists, Age of Horus and flying cars in Star Trek, and they were right, because here we are at the end of the world. So I guess let's break down some of the terms first before we get into Phil Dick and so forth. It's called Brave New World, but you spell it N-O-O. Why is that, Jack?
So a couple of my favorite authors. One was, of course, Philip K. Dick, who described the dystopian realities that we're have emerged into. But another author that I've been very interested in was the old 1940s heretic Teilhard de Chardin, who wrote he was a Jesuit, and he was kind of a heretic of sorts. The church frowned upon his thinking and his writings. In addition to being a theologian, he was also a paleontologist, which gave him a scientific bent as well. But he, in his book Phenomena of Man, he coined the phrase the new sphere, spelt N-O-O, which he indicated to be the cumulative sphere of human thought. And it's circled the globe similarly to the atmosphere. The new sphere was the encompassing human creativity on planet Earth. I would include other sentient species as well in that analogy. But that's where the NOO came from. Also as a play on words with Huxley's Brave New World.
Yeah, exactly. So the new spirit sort of maybe a floating Akashic records where everything is imprinted. Is that something like that?
Yes, that's a good analogy. A lot of your viewers, I'm sure, are familiar with that concept. And it's also a sphere of thought that, in describing the new sphere, it also is a sphere wherein there is a flow of creativity that humanity can reach out and pull in and utilize. Oftentimes, in terms of innovation and creativity, more than one individual on the planet is coming up with similar ideas at the same time. Right. And I believe that to be tapping the new sphere.
Indeed, yeah. Or Jung would call it the collective unconscious. It's all there for us for the taking if we go inward, if we opened our mind through various reasons. So it is far from hopeless, and your book certainly makes a very good case. The other term too that you use is, I don't know if I'm saying ethnography or ethnography. Tell the audience about that.
So the subtitle of the book is A Guerrilla Ethnography of High Strangeness, and so in archaeology and in anthropology, when a archaeologist or an anthropologist embeds themselves within a culture, the investigation that they are pursuing is called an ethnography, wherein they are reporting upon a culture that they have immersed themselves in and are part of. And so that is a good description of my investigations into the realms of high strangeness over the last few decades. I describe it as a guerrilla ethnography, simply to pay homage to the underground nature of high strangeness. And so that's the subtitle.
No, it makes sense. As I always tell people, if you're out on the internet or watching the news, think of yourself as an anthropologist. Detach, observe, and see what reality tunnels they're coming from. It makes life a lot easier, and you don't have to take things personal. You learn and so forth. And the other quote you just, or the other term you just brought up is high strangeness. Tell the audience about what in the tarnations is high strangeness. We want some of that.
a little high strangeness goes a long way this day and age. So high strangeness is a state of cultural bewilderment. The term high strangeness was in my research. The term high strangeness was coined back in, I have my notes here, back in November 27th, 1978, while Dr. J. Allen Hynek was addressing the United Nations, and he was describing the nature of the UFO phenomena, and he described it in terms of being a phenomena that is so strange as to be totally bewildering to common thought. And so high strangeness kind of emerged out of that understanding. And really, in fairness, it is and continues to be closely associated with the UFO phenomena as a cultural phenomena, or, as a new world religion. It was traced throughout modern history by various pundits such as Robert Anton Wilson. It figures prominently in the great post-World War II global religion, which of Discordianism, which is a fittingly a parody religion.
Right.
It essentially describes how in modern times the mainstream of our culture has slowly given way to the periphery, or fringe think. So that's a brief synopsis of high strangeness. No,
it's a good one and useful. Excuse me. Yeah, I don't know if your writing also reminds me a lot of Eric Davis's writing. both of you go for the high strangeness. He calls it high weirdness, you know, that intersection. Like you said, the fringe is not just mainstream, but it's also a hodgepodge, whether you're talking about Robert Anton Wilson or Philip K. Dick. Now it's, you throw all these things like UFO, occultism, conspiracy thinking, psychedelics, social political issues, you just throw them together and you have this, what he would call high weirdness and you would call high strangeness. And it's,
I always recommend that you stir well after you throw all those pieces.
But that's where the answers are. And I think that's where everything is speaking. Again, our pop culture is speaking, our art is speaking. And if you can navigate, again, this stew, that's where you find the answers. There's no way getting around it. It's like, there's something I wanted to bring up, Jack. There was a, I don't know who said it, but he made an astute remark that when we see traditional science fiction, whether it's Star Trek or Star Wars or any of those, there's no pop culture in there. Well, and even, which is very strange, right? If you see Darth Vader and Luke in the elevator, you don't hear some song and, you know, one turns around, hey, this is a good tune. Yeah. Or you don't see like the stormtroopers or the Star Trek crew talking about a sports event, or, oh, there was this great concert the other day. It's completely omitted. And part of Philip K. Dick's genius is that he included pop culture and how important it was, both as a tool of liberation, but also a tool of oppression by the Archons. So there is Absolutely. Pop culture. I mean, yeah, from Linda Fox in The Divine Invasion to some protagonists being talk show hosts, and they're trying to figure out the pop music and the art. So I think that's what Philip K. Dick was ahead of the curve, and it's very important today, right? There's that holiness and mysticism in pop culture.
And I would be remiss if I did, as you know, from our previous interview, some of my pop cultural bringing up, that at the beginning of Valis in Philip K. Dick's book, he quotes the Grateful Dead in the opening chapter. It's his girlfriend actually quotes the Grateful Dead at the very beginning of that book. And so, yes, pop culture is it permeates our experience of the planet, you know. And in terms of high strangeness or high weirdness, it has permeated our culture to the extent that even the great laggards of our culture, the politicians, have begun to utilize the terminology of high strangeness and high weirdness when the left and right, they love to call each other weird now. That's the new.
That's true.
You know, so when the politicians pick it up, you know it's pervasive.
Yeah, exactly. I would like to say politics that's downstream from culture, and there's just catching up. And of course, the whole UFO thing. And it's, these are definitely high strange times indeed. And so for Philip K. Dick, tell us what you, in your book, how do you present him, or what of his, some of his solutions, or tell us how Dick makes an appearance in your book and you synthesize his gnosis.
So Philip K. Dick was, as you are well aware, he was a very interesting author. And after his own bout with gnosis, he inexplicably spent the remaining years of his career pursuing the idea of gnosis and intuitively derived knowledge. But Philip K. Dick also was, he talked about the empire. And in his understanding, the empire was simultaneously a political instrument as well as a pervasive predator-dominator culture that existed throughout history. And he described it very well. He basically described the empire as the institution or the codification of derangement. And that's kind of
I actually quoted, I have it right here.
Oh, nice.
The Empire's institution, the codification of derangement, it is insane and imposes its insanity on us by violence, since its nature is a violent one. There you go.
So that was his framing for the patriarchal dominated culture that we have spent the last 2000 years in. And so he was very eloquent in describing it. And he also was spent a lot of his later writings in strategizing ways to battle empire. But as you know, the whole idea of waging a resistance against the empire is a paradox, because as Philip K. Dick pointed out, to do battle against the empire is to become the empire. So the challenge, of course, is how to resist while recognizing that resorting to the tactics of the empire essentially makes you turns you into a component of the empire.
Yeah. I think that what's the quote, to fight the empire is to be infected by its derangement. So, and of course, Nietzsche kind of said the same thing, fight not ye monsters, lest ye become a monster. So You become what you hate and you become what you want to destroy. And so I think he's right. That is a cosmic law. And we see it over and over again through history, and especially then the latest, manifestation of the empire behind the hologram, which is, of course, the American empire and its satellite country. So I think Dick was spot on, and it still resounds. And in your book, too, you also talk about these are Gnostic times. And I know that's, I think it was definitely originally quoted by, I think, 2016 by Chris Knowles in his blog, Secret Sun, because again, we think 2020 was weird. We think 2024, but the problem is, I think every year has been pretty weird since, I don't know, since forever, if we look at it, because he was talking about, remember, 2016 was a very high weirdness year for the election and the deaths of all these stars like Prince and David Bowie. There was something in the air. And I remember even in Chicago, the Cubs winning the pennant after 100 years and it being 80 degrees at the end of October. Chris kept saying on his blog, these are Gnostic times because the simulation is getting weird. The archons are showing their hand. It's just, there's like this existentialist funk that the Gnostics warned about, and you have to get yourself out of it. But yeah, tell us what you think are these are Gnostic times.
Well, that was a very good primer to the whole concept, the pre-biblical and biblical era Gnostics were very interesting thinkers, in that they operated much as did Philip K. Dick on multiple levels. So when they would describe their struggle with archons, on one hand, on the mundane plane, the word archon was a title given to a dignitary or a politician, often described. My favorite definition I found of it was petty ruler. So the archons were like the Roman overlords in Judea, when the Gnostics did right. battle with. Simultaneously, they described their struggle as also being one on a spiritual plane, wherein the archons were the rulers of the seven planets in that time, including the sun and the moon. And the archons were the rulers, the chief ruler amongst them being the demiurge. So living in Gnostic times for me allows the multiple metaphor so that we can be describing our mundane existence while also describing a more spiritual struggle. It's been described as a war in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's that's kind of the gnosis or the knowledge, the intuitive knowledge derived out of using the Gnostic metaphor.
And it works, and it's true. I hate to say it, and Dick predicted it, and so did others. I mean, we can even go beyond the high strangers to like William Burroughs and others, how our future would be this technological hellscape or very weird world where you don't know what's up and down. You know, somebody's pulling the strings. You know, our destiny has been limited and we've been confined over and over and again. And of course, with Dick, it wasn't even it wasn't even a philosophical conclusion. Later on, it was, but it was an actual vision. 2374 was like, oh my God. We really are in Gnostic times. We're in the 3rd century, and I'm the Apostle Thomas.
Yeah, that was his psychedelic time slip, for sure.
Indeed. And I wanted to ask you about his predictions, because that's been discussed so much, and I wrote some of them here. Obviously, things like face recognition, like in a scanner darkly, self-driving cars, the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence and cloning, the surveillance state again, where it's this, we seem to live in a free place full of pop culture, but it's actually a tyrannical surveillance state behind the scenes. The idea that we're living in a simulated reality, computer generated world, that he was ahead of the times. There's so many predictions that he made, but I think what others have noticed, and let me know your opinion, is not just his predictions, but he described the texture and atmosphere of our world, if you know what I mean. How we existed in this place, as Eric Davis says, where everything seems to be broken. Humanity's broken. Culture's broken. Our gods are broken. Our government is definitely broken. And there's this separation of some have noticed that another way he described our reality is the idea of something of technology and something being degenerating. What's the word that he used? Got it on the top of my head. I have it over here. Where is it? Decay. Sorry about that, guys. That there is decay. There is also, and you see that in Blade Runner, Ridley Scott got it right, because like Dick's novels, you've got Tyrell Corporation, this place run, this technological utopia run by technocrats, and it's beautiful and occult. But then the rest of society, you can tell, was once thriving, but it's crumbling apart. Everything's breaking down. There's violence. Everything's falling apart. So he really, and San Francisco has become that, hasn't it? You've got, the technocrats in Silicon Valley, and the rest of the city is decaying. It's falling apart. Yes, our technology is great, and you can get an Uber and all that, but there's this, it's not the traditional haves and have-nots. Is this a more, the separation of decay and technology? What do you think of this, or what do you see?
What Philip K. Dick got right was just that vision, that vision of a utopia / dystopia that was simultaneous, the simultaneous existence of both.
That's it. Yeah.
And you actually pointed to it a minute ago when we were describing High Strangeness. One of the things that Philip K. Dick really got right in describing the current state of affairs is that he likened the empire to a virus. Mm-hmm. And so, that his writings were prior to the computer revolution. So for him to be able to articulate the binary viral nature of our modern computer world, kind of a soothsaying moment.
It was indeed. Yeah, he's got so many. You can go, I just reread the Valis trilogy a few weeks ago, and of course I learned so much, and right. It just supports the world that it is today, and you can do with any of his novels, Ubik.
Also, Philip K. Dick was really the grandfather of cyberpunk, and that whole genre emerged after his death, actually, but really on his shoulders. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with Neuromancer, William Gibson's epic science fiction trilogy, it really described a dystopian reality that has since come to pass. And, you know, the fanciful strangeness of 1980s cyberpunk genre pretty much nails the 21st century existence that we're living, the surveillance state that was predicted as outlandishly potential, you know, potentialized. Now we get to see it, you know, the whole advent of city planning and engineering. When they talk about smart cities, basically what they're talking about is a completely surveilled city.
That's it.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Yeah, they just put on a nice marketing face. That's what it ends up, and it's only getting worse. Yeah, I was looking at the comments on YouTube. That was actually my next question, because you addressed this in your book, Jack, and I just read it a few weeks ago. Buddha is in the park, and I love that quote. What do you tell us about it? Of course, today on the internet they call it touch grass. In other words, get away from your device and just feel the grass under your feet. That's like, you know, amazing therapy, as strange as it sounds. But Buddha's in the park.
Yeah, the Buddha's in the park. And so that is, that came actually a quote, a Philip K. Dick quote, came out of his first exegesis that was in the back of Valis, out of that first book in the trilogy. And so my inspiration from that quote is twofold. One is, of course, the Buddha, which is all of us. We're all Buddha. And so that's the higher aspects of human nature. And the Buddha in the park, coming with that connotation of Buddha, is the whole sense of meditation and mindfulness. And insert any pop cultural term you want to use for, you know, a meditative state. But the Buddha represents that highest meditative state of humanity. And the park, of course, my inspiration from that is simply nature. Going, unplugging, you know, getting away from the YouTube, getting away from the TikTok streams, and getting out in nature and just tapping into the great network. So, dichotomy.
Exactly. Because as you said, you're right. I mean, Philip K. Dick's idea of these virus, I mean, later Richard Dawkins called them memes. Now memes are just pictures, but this mind virus is true, and computer viruses to Philip K. Dick was different levels of reality. But at the same time, there was a positive virus, right? The plasmate, which came out of the Nagamati virus. So there are good viruses out there, aren't they?
Sure. But that's a very astute point, because that was there's a direct lineage from Philip K. Dick's conversation around virus to the whole analogy of memetics being akin to genetics. So that's a very astute point that you make, and memetics is a particularly fast acting mind virus. You know, it's the poetry of dense and short and to the point.
Yeah, but it's important to know these things. Knowledge is power, and the truth will set you free. But I think we're missing today is, again, what are you going to do with this great responsibility that could, if you can't handle it, if you can't do anything about it? And I think that's where Buddha in the Park is. Work on your spirituality, expand your consciousness, connect yourself to nature, and you'll be 10 times the gorilla in the new sphere that you are. So it's not enough just to have that knowledge. So I think I have a cat here. Graham, I need to let this cat out real quick. You want to ask a question or to Jack, or let us know your views on Dick or what's going on in this wonderful dystopia we live in today?
Oh, no, people don't want to know my whole thoughts on this wonderful dystopia.
Yeah, better pour some, make some coffee, Jack.
I'm going to focus on Phil. And it sounds like my take on what he's saying is it's more or less impossible to fight the empire. So your only option then is to concede to it, or basically what I think is the best option, just ignore the empire and go about and do your business, you know, as if it didn't exist. Am I misreading basically what he's trying to say?
That is absolutely a component of it. And it's also pretty sound advice. You know, it's that's a go-to strategy, you know, ignore it and it'll go away. The vast majority of the inhabitants of our planet pursue that course simply because they're too busy, living to be concerned with the power struggles and dynamics of the Empire of Derangement. But the Empire does impact us and is globally pervasive in to the extent that it is not always possible to ignore it.
Ignore when you can. So what do you think the option is when you can't?
So first of all, be mindful of the point that Philip K. Dick made about empire, which is to do battle with the empire is to become the empire. So an overt struggle, and especially a fire with fire strategy, only tends to pull you into the empire versus liberating yourself from the empire. And so I enjoy your take on that, simply because ignorance of empire is not, it does not mean that to be uninformed. It simply means that you're ignoring it, right? That's the root word for ignorance, is to ignore. And so that's a strategy. However, when it can't be ignored, the best counter insurgent move against empire is to remain calm and approach it with a sense of humor, because the empire and the predator dominator culture does not have a sense of humor. And keeping a sense of humor in your resistance allows you survivability over the seriousness of the situation.
Makes sense. But make sure your humor's funny as opposed to the most recent Joker movie. Tag.
That's funny.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And
I love a good musical.
Yeah, those are rare. Those are rare. And what do you guys think? I mean, Phil was writing these novels and already laying the groundwork even before his Valis experience, late 50s, 60s. I mean, a real pioneer. But what do you guys think in the 70s? And even Family Guy makes fun of it. The sci-fi became very dark, existentialist, even Gnostic. I mean, whether it was the Omega Man, Logan's Run, Rollerball, I mean, very dystopian. And then it kind of went away. What do you think that's the reason, Jack? Again, obviously, well, 60s writers like Dick and disillusionment with Vietnam in the 60s. I mean, there was probably a lot of it, right? A lot of reasons.
Yes, and you know, and in that
example, Planet of the Apes, somebody brought up, of course, another classic. Yeah.
Well, that was the point I was about to make. In 1968, it was kind of the apex of that phase of science fiction. In that year, both The Planet of the Apes and 2001: A Space Odyssey both came out. Synergistically, they both utilized the use of Lake Mead as part of their dystopian setting. Right. And both movies were very influential, and especially in pop cultural terms, of course. Right. You know, 2001: A Space Odyssey, that really gave the modern world a real glimpse of the potential of artificial intelligence, you know, and with the HAL 9000. You know, and it's funny because now here we are in the 21st century and we all were worried about HAL 9000, but instead we got Siri. And then opposed to that, in that same year, of course, was The Planet of the Apes, you know, and so there's some great cultural one-liners coming out of that movie.
Damn you to hell. Get your paws off me, you dirty ape.
Again, Dick's writings of the 70s and 80s became the predominant material for the 80s and late 20th century, early 21st century movies. You know, just think about the long list of movies that came out that were Philip K. Dick stories. You know, the obviously Blade Runner was a classic example. Total Recall. There was two boots of Total Recall. Minority Report. You know, the list goes on and on. And so Philip K. Dick really kind of drove the zeitgeist in Hollywood, you know, right up until the point where they decided to go with Marvel.
And even then, they steal the multiverses simulation. Yeah, they've stolen all that good stuff.
Right.
And yeah, as we were talking before the interview, we were discussing Steven Snyder's work, and in his latest book on Stanley Kubrick, he makes a very good argument that 2001: A Space Odyssey is just one, just like the Gnostic Gospels. It seems like a gospel, but both are it's one ritual to transcend time and space, this Neoplatonic Gnostic astral ritual to teach us how to evolve. And I think something like that you would watch, and I'm sure it expanded the mind of a lot of people. It was just potent gnosis. I mean, as I'm writing this book on David Bowie, when he got stoned and he went to watch 2001: A Space Odyssey, and it just changed his consciousness. He wrote his song Space Oddity like a week after that. So it was a huge influence, these ideas and how it opened expansion. What about you, Graham? Are we missing any good 70s dystopian movies or any that you particularly like?
I was going to say, we're doing a good job hitting them. I was going to say the Logan's Run movie is at least watchable. The TV show was bad. Now, I was going to say, on Planet of the Apes, it's one of those where I was always amused in the Tim Burton remake where he got Charlton Heston to give an anti-gun speech.
Yeah, dreadful movie. Yeah, and even some of the early 80s, like you said, Blade Runner, Tron. Tron doesn't get as much love as it should. Talk about a Philip K. Dick inspired movie.
Here's a lost dystopian from between 2001 and Star Wars is Silent Running.
That's a classic. That's a good one. Very good film.
Yeah, good environmental,
all predictive of where we are. So awesome. And moving on to, while we're on the topic of Gnosticism, and we want to get to some of the solutions eventually, because again, your book does bring solutions. You have been talking about these solutions. But I love your connection between Gnosticism and voodoo. And I was like, wow, this is really impressive. Please share with the audience about how both have similar worldviews.
So, you know, I start that chapter just basically describing how certain cities in our nation have a certain vibe. And so, for instance, New York City could be described as the you know, the brains of the outfit, the thinking node of our culture. On the opposite end of the continent, you have San Francisco, which is could be described as the heart of the country. But I pick New Orleans, you know, the Big Easy, as being the soul of our nation. And New Orleans was the home, was really the Ellis Island of the African diaspora, you know, all the cultures that came up from the Caribbean through the slave trade and thereafter really was the foundational cultural marker that triggered, you know, via the blues and jazz and all of the pieces that came through New Orleans and through up through the Delta, really speaks to the, you know, the modern makeup of our pop culture, because there's a direct lineage from, you know, from hot jazz with Louis Armstrong to cool jazz with Miles Davis, you know, through rock and roll, through up to hip hop culture that is thriving today. It's a direct lineage, and so that, you know, to me that drives the nature of the soul of our current culture.
Very true. Yeah, in your book also you mention what's a book that you mentioned? Ishmael Reed's novel Mumbo Jumbo.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, where you have the Wallflower Order, which is the Illuminati. I always have to have, you know, the shadowy government or the archons in the background. But you also talk about some of the mythologies of voodoo, and Haitian voodoo. For example, they have a distant creator god named Banye, which is French from good Lord. And then you talk about the Loas, who are like, they're the archons of sort. And I believe William Gibson taps into them in Count Zero. Right. And the serpent is very important, which to voodoo, which of course in Gnosticism, the serpent is also a holy Sophianic figure.
Absolutely.
What am I missing? Or tell us more.
Well, I like that because, and I'll just touch on this, the serpent just for a second, because sure. You know, the serpent is the knowledge bringer, both in the voodoo, which is again from the African prehistoric African traditions. It's also from the Gnostic perspective, the serpent is the ancient entity that brings knowledge to humanity via the apple, right? The interesting thing of voodoo and the New Orleans hoodoo, it's a syncretic religion in that the practitioners of voodoo incorporated the saints, the Christian saints, in their ritual. And that thereby protecting themselves from the ire of the dominant church. And so rather than speaking of these Loas in terms of African deities, they describe them as saints. So the greatest most profound Loa in the voodoo tradition is Alegua or Papa Legba, as he is described. Papa Legba makes an appearance also in Count Zero, who is a direct correlation to Saint Peter, who is the guardian of heaven. You know, Papa Legba is the guardian of the gate. you know, similarly to St. Peter, who is going to either let us in or not. You know, my plan is to walk in backwards like I'm walking out when the time comes. Good.
Yeah, exactly. Trick.
So the whole voodoo culture really clothed itself through mimicry. I describe that, the art of mimicry, in the book as well a little bit. But they clothed themselves in the Christian trappings. So in slip under the radar of the priesthood, while they continued to pay homage to the ancient traditions that they modernized and brought forth. And really, and as you pointed out, very similar to the archonic powers, different Loa have different attributes. And unlike the Christian God who you pray to on high, the Loas, you know, they get down to business. That you go to a specific Loa for a specific problem, and you perform the right ritual, you can expect results, right? So it's very transactional.
Right. Yeah, good section in your book, and yeah, I have to reread it, and it's great to expand, obviously. It kind of makes sense. He'd have these Gnostic themes. The Gnostics talked about being in a diaspora. The universe was a diaspora. We were trapped in some slave colony. And of course, African-Americans in that place understood the idea of being displaced, of being in this place of hostile power so far away from home. So it makes sense that the mythology would sort of parallel one way or another. Yeah. And you'll like, Jack, in my book on Elvis coming out in April, I have a whole chapter paralleling Philip K. Dick and Elvis, and their similarities are so eerie. It's, you're going to be very surprised, including Stanley Kubrick. Both were mind blown by Stanley Kubrick, and it really changed the way they were. I mean, look at Elvis's outfits in the late 60s. Notice how he started looking more like a spaceman. What do you think? What do you think did that? Just as David Bowie and his looks and songs. So, nice. A lot of parallels. And of course, Elvis really knew, he really tapped into blues and gospels. And he says, yeah, because these people know what it is to be lost in a place and have this sense of longing and melancholy. And he really thought that that energy was magical, if you know what I mean. So
absolutely. You know, and Elvis had his feet in two worlds, you know. He was simultaneously inspired by the gospel music of the Southern camptown meeting phenomena, and as well as, you know, as well as bringing that experience to the Caucasus, you know, to the Caucasian population.
No, very true. And I think what I try to say in the book, and I'll keep repeating, is rock music was never meant to be a form of entertainment. It was a form of spirituality.
Absolutely.
To help us navigate the empire, because in the 50s, who was the new empire? Who, in fact, it was the most power. The empire had been reborn more powerful than ever. It was the United States government. Satellites, nuclear warfare, mass media. It was like rock music was that buffer. And Elvis, Johnny Cash, Little Richard, they all knew they were simply revamping gospel music to make it more appealing to the world. But yeah, rock music was a form of spirituality. And when we see that, and those who understood that, whether it's the Beatles and Hinduism, Led Zeppelin and paganism, when you see rock music as a form of spirituality, that's, you tap into so much power, you can literally change the world as these cats did. So
yeah, absolutely.
So that's my argument, but nevertheless, let's move on to another very important religious movement. As you say, this movement was Operation Mindfuck. I guess we can say it now. Their idea
of are we culture. 20 minutes in?
Yeah, we are. I think all the children have left. They went to TikTok instead of looking at our old faces. But that would be Discordianism. And as you write, Jack, it is the first great world religion to emerge after the dropping of the atomic bomb over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So tell us about how important it is and how this idea of culture jamming and Operation Mindfuck, well, it does continue today, as you point out, in 2000 with Keck and Q and all the weirdos. But tell us about these spiritual tools to fight the empire.
Well, the intent of Operation Mindfuck is simply to expose the absurdity of the dominant paradigm. When it's experienced individually, it's like when one has their mind blown, and it's just some situation, some experience is so bizarre, so untenable as to just bewilder the individual's thinking, to the extent that he breaks free of the bonds of traditional thought and is illumined. Right, it's a method of illumination. It also traditionally is, as you pointed out, a culture jammer function. It serves as a guerrilla tactic to do battle with empire. And the beauty and of Discordianism, which is why I converted to Discordianism, is that they describe the great dichotomy of the material universe, the great yin yang of the material universe, in terms of seriousness versus humorousness. And so when the empire embraces seriousness in their domination, then of course the mindfuck will utilize its polar opposite of humorousness to do battle with the dominant paradigm, which is goes back to Graham's earlier point, which is how do you battle the empire without becoming the empire? And the answer, the possible answer, is to maintain a sense of humor and to utilize humor as the culture jamming tactic.
So what's an example of culture jamming? I guess today, and of course, if I'm cold, please let me know, but today, you know, AI is being used against us. Again, the great threat. So now people on the internet are obviously using AI against the empire because you see all these deep fake of both politicians and everything. And dancing. Politicians want to ban. They're furious, but they're so funny. And we don't mind. We know they're fake. Well, hate to say it, but you politicians are fake and you're always lying. So at least these are kind of humorous.
Right. You know, in the book, with the example that I make of an Operation Mindfuck or a Mindfuck operation is what's known as image appropriation. And so in that, I'm sure a lot of your viewers have seen a very classic example of image appropriation, wherein an artist will take especially a corporate image and change it to actually reveal its true nature. So the one I have in mind, of course, is the classic red blazoned with white lettering of Coca-Cola, but it reads capitalism. And so that is a classic example of mindfuck, right? Because it reveals the true nature of the very sanitized, presentation.
Yeah. And again, it is going on today. So people keep doing your own culture jamming and Operation Mindfucks. It's out there in the social media, on the internet. By the way the empire is reacting, you know, we're hitting them and that they're feeling things slipping away. I mean, for the audience too, as I say in the show, the Gnostics, the ancient texts, they are indeed satirical pieces. They are parodies. They are mocking both the god of the the creator God, but they're also mocking the Roman Empire in very subtle ways. They're mocking priests. They're mocking politicians. They're mocking those who want to make laws. So that was already in the air. And again, it really raised the hackles over the church and the secular powers. Jack, I was thinking last night, and I was thinking, it's so underrated, but Mad Magazine might have been the greatest culture jamming tool of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Remember how good it was at satirizing and just exposing?
Loved it. Loved Mad Magazine. It's still around in digital.
Oh, it is.
Oh, yeah. It still has a digital presence.
Oh, I might have to check it out. But God, it was the way it satirized movies and politicians and nuclear war. I mean, as a kid, it made me laugh. It just made me laugh and a teenager. It's nothing like it.
Same. And as a kid, growing up, you know, we grew up in a similar area, I might be a little longer of tooth than you, but, you know, I grew up with comic books, of course, but then at one point, a family member got me a subscription to a little known magazine called Man, Myth, and Magic. And in it, it was kind of a precursor to Gnosis magazine in a sense. And so a lot of very mystical, magical concepts were explored in that short-lived run. It only came out like half a dozen issues, but it was very. But it was one of the earliest introductions to Gnosticism for me as a adolescent.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds! Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
We now return to the end of a depressing 1970s sci-fi movie starring a guy in a turtleneck.
We've gone far enough. I think we're safe from the corporation here.
Adzin, look!
It can't be! No! We'll never defeat the corporation! They've won!
There is one way, Adzin. You can shoot yourself.
If it's the only way, I must.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Do you feel like you're going through life clouded by doubt? Talk to California Psychics. Our trusted and accurate psychics are available 24/7, and we guarantee if it's not life-changing, it's free. Download the app or connect with us at californiapsychics.com. Right now, new customers get 80% off their first reading. Experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.